With me right now, McCoy Tyner, that also featured Ron Carter on bass and Elvin Jones on the drums. McCoy Tyner, jazz pianist and composer, is one of the giants of modern jazz piano. He's a West Philadelphia native, and McCoy was a cornerstone with the John Coltrane Quartet in the early 1960s, recording frequently on the Impulse label. Many of those sessions are now being reissued, as well as sessions from that period which are now being put out for the first time. In 1965, McCoy left the Coltrane Quartet to form his own group, working with musicians like Ron Carter, Lee Morgan, and Joe Henderson. By the early 70s, he began enjoying increasing success as a band leader and establishing one of the most identifiable and personal approaches to the piano. He has recorded many albums on the Milestone label, the most recent being Horizon. McCoy returns to Philadelphia frequently to play and is at the Bijou Cafe in Center City tonight and tomorrow night with sets at 8:30 and 11:30. For further information on those concerts, you can call the Bijou at 735-4444. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a real honor to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
When I go see you in concert and I take a friend with me, the different friends I'll take will frequently comment, "Boy, that guy has chops. He must have been classically trained." And I always have to turn around and say, "I'm not sure how he was trained. I know he went to Granoff School in West Philadelphia."
Mm-hmm.
But could you tell us a little bit about your training?
Yeah, well, actually, this is my old stomping grounds right here, you know, at 46 Market, and I lived on Fairmont Avenue between 46 and 47th, you know, around me and Fairmont. So when I first started playing, we had a sort of a beginner teacher around here, Mr. Habershaw. I don't know if he's still around or not, but he used to teach the younger children in the neighborhood. So, you know, I started taking lessons from him, and then I went to West Philadelphia Music Center, which was at 52nd and Walnut, I think.
It really is your old stomping ground.
Yeah, right. This is right here, and studied it for a while, and then went to Granoff Music School. Although at Granoff, I studied theory a little bit. You know.
Did you have much classical training?
A little bit. I think that I used to practice a lot. You see, I think the key to technique building is practicing every day. You
mm-hmm.
know, I think that a consistent schedule. Some piano players or some musicians, they may practice. Younger guys, they will practice maybe 20 minutes one day, and then you know, that sort of thing. You know, but if you sort of establish a steady thing, a steady flow every day, practice maybe an hour or something like that a day. You know.
What was the jazz scene like when you were growing up in Philadelphia? I mean, there were a lot of people here, people like Lee Morgan, Richie and Bud Powell lived around the block from you apparently for about a year.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Very rich, very, very fertile for music. You know, I think it was one of the greatest scenes, you know, growing up here. You know.
Were you in touch with other musicians that are still in Philadelphia but didn't become as widely known as, you know, like Lee Morgan, for instance?
Yeah, there are a lot of great musicians still here. Yeah, a lot of good guys, you know, that I knew, and where some of the older musicians, I think I credit them my success partially to their help and their support. There were a lot of guys that really helped me out a lot and gave me a lot of support
as a
teenager.
How about Bud and Richie Powell? Did you do much shedding with them or hanging out?
No,
musically?
No. Bud used to come by. He lived around the corner for a while because his family, I think, lives in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. You know, they did. I don't know if they still do or not. But they had an apartment around the corner for me, and he used to come around. I think once he came around and played my piano, you know, when I was only about 15 years old.
What did that do to you?
Well, that was really great because we used to follow Bud around. You know, we had a place called Rittenhouse Hall up at, I think it was 53rd and Haverford. And we used to go up there and they had sessions. That was like a musician's place, and we used to jam all night. Some guys lived there, and we had dances on the weekend. So it was very interesting.
When did you meet John Coltrane?
I met John, I think, in the mid-50s. I think it was around 55.
Can you tell us about the beginning of that relationship? Because it's such a significant group of...
Yeah, well, I think that... during that period, that was a very important period in my life because I met my wife around the same time who's sharing her presence with us right here. And I met John around that time. As a matter of fact, he was with, this was a period where, an interim, you know, between being with Miles for the first time in the early 50s, he was with Miles Davis, and then he rejoined Miles later. But during this time, he was in Philadelphia and his mother was here and he was staying with her for a while. And I met him in this period, during this time, you know. And well, we actually met with one afternoon. I was playing with a friend of his, Calvin Massey, who's also from Philly, you know, and we were playing at the place called Red Rooster. The building is still there. It's another. The club is named something else. And I happened to meet John. We had a matinee, and I met him one afternoon, actually.
What was your first club sitting in like?
Well, actually, what happened is the club owner was familiar with John. He asked him, could he come in the next week? And John didn't have a rhythm section, so Jimmy Garrison, myself, and Albert Heath joined John. And we did the next week with him. So I was about 17 then. It's the first time playing with him. Yeah.
How was he as a leader, you know, in the early 60s when the quartet really started going?
Oh, he was a beautiful person to work for, you know. Very serious. It was a tremendous experience for me working with him because, you know, it was like he was a genius as far as I was concerned.
Well, part of his genius was striking out in new directions almost constantly.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
every
right.
couple of years there'd be another real wealth of musical ideas coming out of that. Now, as the pianist in that quartet, how did you follow that evolution of ideas?
Well, you had to grow along with it. See, that group was distinct because of the fact that it wasn't just a matter of following. You had to develop right along with the what was happening, you know. And I think John often said that he played according to what was around him as well. So we had to be right on the ball in order to really, you know, keep the thing happening. So it was a total group growth sort of thing. Yeah.
Did he, or did you rap about in a conceptual way some of the new directions?
No, they just happened. That's the ironic thing about it, is that they just happened naturally. And because we all were very serious about what we were doing and very dedicated to music. And when you take that sort of approach, I think that you don't have to do too much discussing.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So we had very few rehearsals. I can't even remember how
right.
many. Very few.
How would John Coltrane take the reviews when he'd move out into a new direction?
Well, I can't say that they didn't bother him at times. You know, sometimes he got very a lot of the negative reviews about some of the things he was doing. You know, and of course there were some people who really believed, you know, in what he was doing and really liked what he was doing. You know, but then there were some people who just couldn't adjust to the change. So therefore, he would get some sort of negative reviews. But we would take it in stride, and he remained firm, and we would give each, you know, give him a lot of, you know, confidence because we were right there with him, you know. See, so we'll just keep going, you know.
One of the interesting things, and I first heard this, I guess, on Impressions, which is a real significant album that the quartet put out, is that you laid out during solos.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really a drastic, dramatic type of thing because, you know, there's not this, you're not comping, there's not this this type of flow that you expect from a rhythm section, and then it gets down to something that really you can hear other rhythmic ideas that Coltrane was doing.
Yeah.
Why did you start doing that?
I objected to it at first. I didn't like the idea because I felt as though I was sitting here and doing nothing. But actually I wasn't, you know, really. I mean, it was just, it added another dimension to the music. Because Elvin and John had a chance to have an exchange, and actually, what it does is it creates a whole other texture in the music because, you know, it gives it a little bit more freedom, you know, and then when the piano comes in, it can take it to another level, you know. So you give the artist, or you give the soloist a chance to really build something, you know, without. You know, and then you come in, and if you want to, you know, take it into another direction, you can, or help him support what he's doing, what he's already built. So that was that type of thing, but it really worked well, I think, for the group. You know, laying out, I really saw, and plus, John should play very long solo, so I didn't see. I realized it was a blessing in disguise.
Right, keeps the wrists and forearms cool for a little.
Yeah, that's right.
Was it hard to leave the quartet when you left? Why did you leave?
Well, actually, I left because before I left, I was thinking about leaving because I felt as though I wanted to try some things on my own. And then there was one main reason was I couldn't really hear myself. I was surrounded by Rasheed Ali and Elvin Jones on either side of the stage, and I really couldn't hear the piano. The piano's not really, it's an acoustic instrument, and it only, it requires amplification because it is acoustic. And when you get surrounded by, you know, two drummers, you know, it's really difficult to, you know, to hear it. You
yeah.
see? So I really, some nights I couldn't hear hardly anything I was doing, you know. So I asked him, I said, well, you know, what are you hearing? He says, well, I'm hearing a lot of drums, a lot of percussion things, you know. And I said, well, that's fine, but I'm getting really drowned out, you know. So And then I felt as though it was time for me to leave at the time. Yeah,
right. Well, I want to, in a couple minutes, talk about the directions that you went out into. Mm-hmm. But just one last question about that era.
Yeah.
It seems like in reading interviews that were done about that time or liner notes on albums that questions of political consciousness in the music or mm-hmm. or blackness in the music or, mm-hmm. or extra musical statements that would relate to the music were really important then.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you relate to those questions at that time?
Well, actually, I think there was a conscious level, I think, during that time. And in terms of the public at large, I think that people were identifying with certain things that were very important, you know. And we were sort of like within the flow of that thing. I think the whole atmosphere during that time, I mean, not only with the college students, but the black people, it was just a total society was going through changes. And I think there were a lot of good things that came out of that period. I think that a lot of good music, a lot of good poetry, a lot of good things in general, because I think that sometimes things have to be shaken up in order for inventory to be taken. You know,
mm-hmm,
I think that
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's good for a country or a person or a community or whatever sometimes to take inventory. And I think that was inventory time. I think that it was also a very creative period. And I think that the music played a part. I think we were more or less functioning on the vibes that were created during that time.
Do you think those questions are at all relevant today?
Well, it's...
They're not asked as much.
Yeah, well, it's a little different situation today. As a matter of fact, in some ways, quite different, you know. I think that some of the seeds are still around. I think good things should remain. I think that in every period, I think that sometimes people have a tendency to discard good things very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes it's good to maintain those things, you know.
Well, when you left the quartet... You started as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Was that at all like starting again in terms of working up again to the level of acceptance or success?
To a point it was.
Was
I
it
think,
difficult to do that?
Well, what it was, it shouldn't have been difficult, I don't think, but it was difficult because at the time you had the approaching fact of rock came in around that period, and it was like... It was a little detrimental in terms of, the way it was thrust at people and the fact that a lot of the other music was really, like, sort of put aside.
Yeah, it really robbed the teen audience.
Yeah, it really did. And so a lot of us suffered, not only me, but a lot of musicians and also airplay and stuff like that. We didn't get a lot of music was really... didn't get a chance to get exposed in the air, so it was a rough period during that time.
If I'm understanding the chronology right, by around the early 70s, you really started picking up momentum with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things that I listen for in your new records as they come out, mm-hmm. or each time I see you, is perhaps there will be another new pianistic approach.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that occurs to me is I remember in the early 70s, somehow things started sounding very percussive,
mm-hmm.
Very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Am I communicating?
Mm-hmm. Most interesting, yeah.
Where do those new approaches happen? Is that something that happens, like you were saying with Coltrane, it happens as you're playing the tunes, or do you sit at home and stumble on something?
Well, I think it's not always conscious. I think that... or contrived. I think that when it's that type of thing, sometimes it's not a natural change. It's a thing that I never try to predict natural changes.
Mm.
I feel as though they should happen naturally, you know. And rather than sit down and say, well, let me just come up with something new, I think that, the atmosphere, sometimes the guys that I'm working with, and, it's various, there are many reasons why those things take place.
Okay, but when you hear something coming, can you hear the germ of a new idea?
Yes, you can.
When that's happening, when something's evolving, are there mistakes, or is anything fair game until you... Will you lay low on something until you understand what you're trying to do?
No. It may come in pieces. It may develop in time. And so, therefore, it's not really a mistake. What it is, it's just an interjection of something new, which will in turn develop into a complete thing. you see. So it's not really like making a mistake. It's like just adding something, and then that particular thing would germinate and grow, and to like the idea will eventually mature like a person, you know. So you don't make any mistakes because you're growing from 5 to 6, you know. It's just that type of thing. You know,
it's something that's going to happen,
and you're just a part of the flow of it, you know, and it just develops, you know, as you go along.
Well, many critics aren't so kind to look at it that way. So how do you react to criticism?
Well, I like constructive criticism, but I'm afraid that a lot of the critics don't criticize or don't view things constructively. What they do, they sometimes try to persuade the thinking of the people, or they don't particularly like an artist personally, or for some reason. I found out that a lot of that goes on instead of a constructive sort of criticism, or really trying to assist an artist, especially an artist that's been established. I feel as though that to deal with that artist harshly or unfairly, I think it's really not good. I think that the person in that position should be conscious of the fact that they do have people out there who aren't aware, or they may be aware or something like that, but just maybe not so sure. And then, you know, you take a guy who's insensitive to an artist who has done a lot of good things, and maybe one thing he doesn't particularly like, and he tries to, and he really crucifies that person. I think that's a little, just not fair.
Well, you've been doing a lot of touring in the last decade, a lot of international traveling, and there also have been appearing some African and Asian type influences, just like in terms of the instruments, some of the references for the titles of the tunes and so forth. How has traveling affected your... Do you go to a country and pick up on something specifically?
Or? Yeah, well, what happened is, I think when I was with John, we were very international in our approach to music. And I like that approach because what it does is it gives you options musically. I think that you can do various things, you know. I mean, receive, various types of influences and really make them make what you're doing broader, you know. And I kind of like that. It gives you more musical options. And there are a lot of things. I think sometimes I feel like when I write a song, I may think of a particular place and say, "Wow, that'd be nice to write a song about this place." Or sometimes it happens the other way, you know, around. You know, sometimes I'll write something that sounds like India, or that sounds Africa, or whatever. But I like that sort of approach, you know, rather than to get locked in a particular thing. I think compositionally, I like to have that. The freedom to do that, you know.
How do different audiences react to you? Different parts of the world react differently?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Are there things that work some places that aren't as successful at others and vice versa?
Well, I found out that what it is that audiences are different in particular places, not because of the music that we play, but because the general character of the people. Like, we were in Europe in the early part of this year, and the countries varied. We played in Spain, we played in Germany, quite a few places in Germany, England, and the people are just they're different, you know, just because nature-wise. I mean, the way they respond to things, some are stiffer than others, you know. Some, it's funny, we played for some audience, someone mentioned the country, but we played for some audience, and it took the second set before they actually got into the music. You know, the first set they were sitting like, well, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't loosen up and absorb this. And then the second set, they loosened up, and the audience was very, you know, they really got into the music. So I think that it all depends on, you know, where you are, you know. It's not so much the music.
How do you think your playing has influenced other players? There's obviously a lot of influence. Are you conscious of it?
Yeah, I am.
How do you feel about it? I mean, some musicians will go so far as to say they feel ripped off. Other musicians will say, you know, well, that's what happens. That's how it is. It's okay. And other, you know, what's your sense of that?
Well, I mean, I don't feel like I'm ripped off because I don't really think that, I don't really think that that they really have, you know, captured, you know, my total personality. It's impossible for somebody to do that.
That's certainly true.
Yeah, I don't think you can really assume someone else's musical character and really be that person. I think that so the influences. It's wonderful that they like what I'm doing. You know, it's just that I feel as though, you know, if it becomes a situation where an individual is, you know, like, say, for instance, held down while another guy takes off on another person's style, I don't think that's so good. But that sometimes that happens, you know, but not in my particular case. I think that, you know.
Do you think that a player, a younger player listening to you and being influenced by you needs magnificent chops to be able to...
No. I think the technique is only good when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to be able to express the ideas that you have, it's good to practice and develop like technical, you know, have technical ability, you know. But I don't think that I think that your technique should grow along with your ideas. You know, just running all over the piano and playing a lot of notes is not really the answer. I only do that when I really feel it's necessary to do it, you know. But otherwise, I don't, just to do it just for the sake of being an exhibitionist, it doesn't make any sense. You know?
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I hope on another trip to Philadelphia you can come back, because there's a lot more to talk about. And thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with McCoy Tyner, and he's leading his own group now, and you'll also know McCoy Tyner from his work with the John Coltrane Quartet in the late 60s. McCoy's playing at the Bijou Cafe tonight, and their sets at 8:30 and 11:30. He's also playing tomorrow night, and you can get in touch with the Bijou at 735-4444. That's 735-4444. And now we're going to hear Go Out with a tune from McCoy's latest album, and that's called Horizon. It's available on Milestone, and it's a tune by the bass player Charles Fambro. Is he playing with you in this engagement?
No, he's not. He's with Art Blakey. So.
Uh-huh.
Right now, yeah.
Well, he's with McCoy on this album, and the name of the tune is One for Honor. That was McCoy Tyner, and he was playing One for Honor. That's on his new record, Horizon.